I have to talk about negative emotions. It makes me so mad. The truth is that although negative emotions are many, the cure is basically one. As in the Bhagavad Gita, it says that their army is... our army is difficult to count, their army is easy to count, meaning that the negative, the ways of making mistakes, the ways of getting into delusion are many. But it's sort of like the branches of a tree going outward from the trunk. The trunk is one, and the closer you get to the trunk, the more you see how everything ties in together into one stem. Whereas the farther you get away from the trunk, out into the twigs and the leaves, the more it seems terribly complex. And if you have many leaves, you may not even see the trunk and therefore not understand where all this comes from, whether it's one plant or many plants and so on. So essentially, what we really need to do is not overcome only negative emotions, but emotions in general. Because as Patanjali said in his definition of yoga, yogas chitta vritti nirod means yoga is the neutralization of the vortices, the eddies of feeling in general. And when we can get away, see, when God created the universe, we could liken God, as Master did, to a lake, and when, or to an ocean rather. And when God chose to create, he put his consciousness into movement and began thinking. And those thoughts created the causal universe, put them into further movement, or I should say those movements created their own sub-movements, as lakes are not just smooth glass, but have many ripples upon, waves, I mean, have many ripples upon their surface too. So those thoughts began to become energetic by becoming more restless, and so it created the astral universe. And then that astral energy began to take on the appearance in the complexity of all these waves of being something totally divorced from the base of it, the source of it, and it took on an appearance of a solid reality of its own, which is this world, an appearance without energy, without consciousness, as if it were completely mindless. But all of these movements really originate from that still, calm center of the ocean. So when God created, we could say that he created these waves. You don't change the level of an ocean by creating waves. You can't make the ocean higher, the level of the ocean higher, by pushing the waves higher. Because every time you've got a wave, you've got a corresponding trough. Now these ups and downs in creation, the whole principle of creation is dvaita, duality. Everything is created in duality. And you can't have one without its opposite. You can't have positive without negative. You can't have joy without sorrow. Love in an emotional way without hatred. Joy in an emotional way without sorrow. Heat and cold and pleasure and pain and so on. We're talking of outward realities, because the joy of God's own existence, the joy is not a reaction to, oh, how wonderful this thing is, a joy that doesn't move outward, but that just rests in itself, this does not have its opposite. God has absolute love, absolute joy, but it's centered in himself, it's in the calm ocean, and there are no opposites to that. But as soon as you get an emotional kind of outward movement of energy, then you've got the beginnings of delusion. This happens with us individually. It happened with God. Not that God is in delusion, but he had to create delusion in order to give an appearance of reality to something that, of course, is not real. Because everything really is just God. There isn't anything but God. So when God brought all this universe into manifestation out of himself, it too could be said to be a kind of emotion. It was motion, and I don't know whether I'm on etymologically sound ground here, But emotion, I would say, could be taken to be movement outward, reaction to something outside yourself. And this movement outward from himself is essentially what we do when we respond to the world outside outside ourselves. When God draws everything back into himself, he brings all that motion back to a center, and everything merges back into consciousness. Now we are, each one of us, you see, it's really a very, very deep and wonderful truth that we need to, I've meditated on it for years, and I always seem to get new feelings about it, new insights into it. That simple statement in Master's Autobiography of a Yogi, where he said that that spiritual vision is center everywhere, circumference nowhere. It's a staggering thought when you think about it. We're not even omnipresent in that sense in our own bodies. We can't say that we're as much in our knees as we are in our head. Our knee is out there. Everything about our body is out there. And if you really traced your consciousness back to its final source in this body, it would be in the medulla oblongata, which is the seat of ego. And from this little germ, everything else is. Everything we do in human consciousness is a radiation outward from one center. That's the only center we actually know. The universe is also center everywhere, circumference nowhere in a physical way, which is to say that there's no way we can find a center to the universe. We can discover a center to a solar system, a center to a galaxy, the center of an atom. We can find centers, but we can't find one center to the universe. There isn't a center. There's no way of really relating anything to anything else. We don't know in a cosmic way whether we're going or coming or coming or going. It's all relative in that kind of movement. So yet in another way we can say that every one of us individually is the center of the universe, because everything that we'll ever understand about the universe begins with where we are. We can't understand the universe clearly in relation to somebody or some other thing. That's really why the approach of yoga is so much greater to the higher realities than the approach of science, because science is always out here. It's always working with instruments. It's got telescopes or microscopes or charts or mathematical formulae or whatever. It's always there. And that's its center. Whereas the real center that even the scientist has to work with is his own consciousness and his own ability to understand what he sees in a microscope. So science, in working out here, has created is working on the periphery of his understanding. If a scientist could get to his own center as a yogi does, then he would be able to see things more clearly. You see, science says that because we are subjective as human beings, we want to get ourselves out of the picture. But we can never get ourselves out of the picture. Science, with all its effort, fails to do so. There was an interesting dialogue between Sir Arthur Eddington and Albert Einstein that was quoted in J.W.N. Sullivan's book, The Limitations of Science. They were on two sides of a problem of physics, and there was no way that they could prove it one way or the other. And finally, Einstein said, "Well, it simply offends me to think the way you do." And Sullivan pointed out that really that means that the higher reaches of science become a matter of taste. We can't get away from it. We're bound to be influenced by the way we see things, by the way we want to see things, by the way we're capable of seeing things, by the way we've been conditioned to see things, however we might describe it. And so the yogis say, that being the case, let me clarify my vision. Let me see things as clearly as I can. There's even this in the whole approach of science. There is a tremendous rebellion on the part of physicists and astronomers now against the very facts that they are discovering. There's a very interesting book I have. I forget the name of it, but it's to do with the more recent discoveries of astronomy and the fact that all the discoveries of astronomy seem to point to the conclusion that the universe was really created in a big bang, and whatever caused that bang in the first place, what was before all that. Scientists are conditioned by their training and outlook to think of the universe as being something that doesn't introduce new things, that whatever is has always been and always works more or less the same way. They don't at all like the concept of sudden great cataclysms. They like to think in terms of these geologic changes as taking place over thousands of years. I remember my father, who was a geologist, I mentioned to him a discovery that I had read about in a book where it said that the plateau in Mexico, which is 7,500 feet high, well, they found on the plateau sands that could only have been created in a sea with shells and all that kind of thing. Well, that's natural. Over millions of years, these plateaus rise and others sink, and on the tops of the highest mountains in the world, you'll find evidence of sea life. But according to what I read, underneath that evidence, they discovered human artifacts, as if either the human race had been around for a very long time, or as if this Mexican plateau had been thrust up very quickly at some point and then subsided and thrust up again. My father simply wouldn't accept that that was true. Maybe it isn't true, I don't know. I did read it as a fact. But the thing is that instead of saying, well, that's an interesting thing, it doesn't fit anything that we know, but it would be interesting to look into, they say, no, it can't be. Absolutely not. They are. This is the response that they are getting also in the face of this discovery of modern science, that the universe was created suddenly. In a matter of seconds, it was already very huge. That it was an incredible power that generated this great explosion. And most scientists today absolutely can't handle that thought, because it leads inescapably to the possibility of a creator. And they have done everything they could to exclude God from their reckoning. Well, this is a kind of emotional prejudice. Why should you exclude it? Max Planck said that a new scientific discovery does not gain acceptance by being reasonable. It gains acceptance because all the old scientists die, and new scientists grow up with these new ideas and get used to them, and so they accept them. So, in the last analysis, it really is true, and you only have to get into the sphere of science to find the kinds of battles that go on that you would expect only on the opera. Prima donnas fighting for position and prestige. When Emanuel Velikovsky, came up with his book, Worlds in Collision, where he postulated that Venus was torn out of the heart of Jupiter, and that accounts for the big, what do they call it, the red mark there, what? Red spot, okay. And that there was all sorts of activity going on a few hundred years ago, a few thousand years ago. Scientists weren't content with scoffing. It went directly counter to what they were teaching and what they believed. They weren't content with scoffing. They wrote in large numbers to the universities that were willing to let Velikovsky speak, to the publishers that were planning to publish Velikovsky, threatening to boycott them if they allowed him a hearing. Well, what is this but emotion? They pride themselves on being absolutely free of emotion. They can't get out of emotion just by trying to be objective in putting their realities out there. They still have this problem of having to relate to those realities. So we come back to what Patanjali said, that really the root of delusion is The constant movement, vortices, he described it as. Some people have likened it to waves in translating him, but his real word was vrittis, which is eddy or vortex. And so he said that to get out of delusion, the only thing that is needed is to make ourselves absolutely still, to the point where we don't respond in a positive or a negative way. We merely, now, does that, a very, very important point here is that, does it make us apathetic? Does it make us uninterested in the world? The natural judgment of a person merely reading this philosophy would be to say, of course. But when you meet yogis, I know that Master Paramahansa Yogananda was a man of incredible joy. If anybody that I ever knew had the capacity to say yes to life, it was he. And yet he was a great yogi. What he was doing was not coming up with positive emotions. He wasn't responding emotionally. First of all, he had reached the point where he saw that everything is what it is. That he didn't need to say, I like it or I don't like it. When somebody's playing tennis and he hits a ball into your court, you don't, if you're a good tennis player, sit there and say, I wish he wouldn't hit the ball in that side when I'm over here. You don't waste time thinking whether you like his ball or don't like his ball. You tell yourself, what can I do about it? And so, in fact, it's a waste of energy to say, I like this or I don't like this. Now, how did Yogananda respond to things then? What is the difference between this kind of joyful response and emotion? What is the difference between being absolutely calm and being apathetic? Well, the thing is that in apathy is really just another kind of emotional response. If you are really at rest in yourself, you will always be in joy. It's a story I've told often, and forgive me for telling it again. One or two of you are new. But it's a marvelous illustration. George Bernard Shaw was at a party one time, and he was sitting on the outskirts of this party by himself. And so the hostess came over to him and she said, aren't you enjoying yourself? He looked up, he said, that's all I am enjoying. The truth is that we really only and ever enjoy ourselves. That is to say, whatever joy you have is inside yourself. And to be apathetic means you haven't touched that center yet. The neutralization of these waves and bringing them back to an even point in the center is to bring them to a point of absolute joy, because the source of all creation is bliss. Satchidanandam, ever existing, ever conscious, ever new bliss. So that center of bliss is what we really are. And if we are feeling apathetic, we've merely sort of, we've reached a point of such fatigue that when the wave goes up, we no longer can be excited about it. We're still going with the wave. We no longer feel happy. We're still going, however. Now then, the point is that in the center, between these two opposites, is bliss. And when a master feels bliss in himself, he can enjoy everything. Sometimes people say, oh, I like this because master liked this. Or they say, oh, master liked this and that and the other thing, and this is a sort of, that makes those things wonderful. The truth of it is, surely a disciple likes to feel, because it's a way of remembering his guru, that, well, my guru liked mangoes, and so I'll remember him when I eat mangoes. That's another aspect of it. But the truth is that there wasn't anything he didn't like, in one sense, because he always enjoyed himself. And he could always be in that joy. You see, the difference between an emotional response and having this joy inside is like what Sri Yukteswar said in the autobiography of a yogi, where he said, be like the capacious ocean receiving all tributary rivers of senses into yourself. Which is to say that everything that you see outside yourself that you enjoy, let it remind you of this joy within yourself, so that it's not an energy going out, but an energy coming in. And every time you find something beautiful, it feeds that inner energy instead of draining that energy. Most people in the world, their energy becomes drained with their enthusiasms. They become tired. You take a little child to the zoo and he's all eagerness looking at the horses and the elephants and the camels and the pumas and everything. And then after a while, he starts to droop. And after 2 or 3 hours, you just can't make him enjoy it anymore because he's given all his energy to it and he's exhausted. Where if we could really completely live this truth, we would find that everything that we experience feeds this inner energy within ourselves, this inner joy. So, what about sorrow? Even that has its own lesson. There isn't anything negative, really. Everything in the universe is neutral. And it depends on how we respond to it that makes it negative or positive. As Yogananda said, all things are neutral. He also said there are no such things as obstacles. There are only opportunities. So what we should do is summon up the energy when we see some kind of thing that would cause us suffering ordinarily. A master is able to see suffering in the world and to respond sympathetically with compassion and sorrow. But his sorrow is not for himself. His sorrow is for our ignorance that we can't take it. Otherwise, a master can, to use master's words, stand unshaken amidst the crash of breaking worlds. Nothing can shake him. In himself, he's untouched by everything. I would see Master when he would express sympathy for somebody, or when he would express gladness for something, or tell a joke that would have you practically rolling with merriment. And I'd look into his eyes, and I would see that he really wasn't touched at all. It was so hard to know how to relate to him, just for that reason, that he didn't really have a personality in the ordinary sense. He had a wonderful personality in one way of putting it, because he was so compassionate, so loving, so kind, so had such a wonderful sense of humor. Yet, at the same time, as he himself said, I killed Yogananda long ago. No one lives in this temple now but God. And you could see that these were just sort of things playing on the surface of his consciousness. But you look into his eyes and you see that there isn't anybody home. There's just nobody there. It's only God. It's only that unchanging bliss of God. And whether he sees suffering or pain, he sometimes would talk in ways that I didn't write much of that in my book because the average reader is not ready for that kind of thing. But I remember him one time describing God as eating people. Doesn't care. Whether we live or die doesn't matter to God. Because he sees that we don't die, and we don't live. He sees it's all just a part of his own consciousness. So that kind of absolute impersonal attitude, the thing is that in that inner self, there is no emotion. There is feeling, yes, but it's not restless feeling. It's calm feeling. Calm feeling is devotion. Calm feeling is love. Restless feeling is emotion. And what we want to do is have that calm feeling that leads us toward God. Restless feeling is bondage. Restless feeling is reaction to things which prevents us from seeing things as they really are. Restless feeling separates us from other people. As long as you're doing something that I don't like and I get all upset, I'm separated from you. Whereas if I am able to simply sit back and see it as it is, I recognize that this is my center, and from the point of view of my center, I don't like it when you do something to me that will hurt my body. Maybe that's so. But if I'm really wise, then I get to that understanding of my deepest state, my deepest reality. What's the reality of the wave? It isn't the shape of the wave. It isn't the size of the wave. It isn't the reflection that's produced by the wave. These are all temporary. The wave keeps changing shape, size, position relative to the sky and the sun. All these things vary from moment to moment. The reality of the wave is the thing that is constant. The wetness of it, the waterness of it, the saltness of it, whatever you want to say, these are realities of the ocean. The reality of the wave is that which is the ocean. And when we get down to the reality, first of all, of a wave, we can understand the reality of all waves. You don't have to say, if a wave were conscious, it would make a great mistake to say, well, I'm wet, but that doesn't mean other waves are wet. He's reached a level where he can see, oh, this is a wetness that I have derived from a great source. And then he can see that all these things are real. There's a level beyond which that kind of objective skepticism becomes absurd. It's sort of like, was it Harry Hopkins or some other person who worked with, it was Secretary of State or something under Roosevelt. I forget his name, but he was very cautious in his expression. If anybody asked him the time, he'd say, well, what time have you got? And before he'd commit himself. One time he was on a train, and there was a flock of sheep that was on a hillside, and somebody said, oh, those sheep have been shorn. And this man looked out and he said, well, on this side anyway. What we need to do is get away from too much skepticism. And in fact, the experience that happens when a person grows spiritually, gets into his center, is that he actually... it's not just an inference then. It would be an inference perhaps on the part of a person looking at a flock of sheep. It's a safe inference, but still it's an inference. But as you get to your own center, it becomes something much more. That you experience not only that your reality is not these changing things, body, intellect, personality, emotions, and so on. It's that reality that is of the infinite. But then the thing is that you expand from this little reality. You expand outward, not in the way of a dictator who gets control over other people and imposes his will on them. You expand outward in the way that the divine created this universe in the first place. So that with that expansion, there is a center in yourself that radiates outward to the whole universe in one sense. But in another and deeper sense, you also see yourself at the center of every point in the universe, so that you can feel yourself in others. You can feel their realities. You can feel their emotions. And you know that they are the same as you. They are merely expressions of the same reality that you have. Then if somebody does something to you, it's no longer some periphery to your center doing it to you. It's just one center doing it to another center, nothing really happening. That's why you're no longer touched, because you see yourself in all things. As Master was saying, when I was walking around the desert with him, and he had a hard time walking sometimes, he was in a state of samadhi, and I had to hold him up. And he said, it's hard for me to remember which body I'm supposed to control, because I'm in all bodies. That kind of consciousness is what a master has. What we are prevented from having, as long as we have this emotional reactive process that says, oh goody and oh dear, oh boy and oh darn, up and down, reaching out to embrace, reaching back to reject, both of these things are, in a sense, just opposite sides of the same coin. I'm not going to end up saying that we want to not that we don't want to have positive emotions on a certain level, but on the highest level, we don't want to have either positive or negative emotions. We want to be willing, first of all, and this is what we can't do as long as we have emotions. We want to be willing to simply accept things as they really are, not as our emotions color them. You find that was the difference between Master and other great saints and worldly people. What made him seem so deep in his eyes was that he just accepted things as they were. Where other people, you can see flickers of emotion going on in their eyes all the time. Oh boy, oh darn. you can see these emotions sort of flickering like ripples through their eyes all the time. Well, we need to reach the point where we just understand that whatever is, we can't change the fact that it is. Let us accept it. That's why Master used to say, what comes of itself, let it come. This impartiality, this ability to accept, is the beginning of wisdom. Now, Patanjali defined yoga entirely in these terms. That is to say, he said that if we can once overcome these emotions, then we don't have anything left to overcome. We are already one with God. He didn't bother, however, to use the definition of yoga as oneness with God, oneness with the infinite, oneness with the higher self, and so on. He didn't have to, because he said that if you can just do this, everything else is there already. If you can just get rid of that reactive process, that is what separates you from the world around you. That is what keeps you conscious of a little center and the universe as something that only relates to that center, instead of having all its countless, innumerable other centers everywhere. When we understand this, then we have a beginning of understanding that we don't want to, as usual in the human way, we don't want to replace negative emotions with positive emotions, except perhaps in the sense of a person who has a thorn in his thigh and he uses another thorn to take that thorn out, and then he can throw both thorns away. In that way, to have good moods, to be positive, have positive emotions, can perhaps be good, merely to neutralize the negative ones. But in the last analysis, we don't want either one. We want to grow beyond an emotional response to a feeling response. To respond with love is to recognize that these things are a part of me. That is what the emotion even of love essentially tells us. Now then, what are negative emotions? Obviously, we can say that negative emotions are such things as hate and anger and jealousy and pride and passion and lust and greed and avarice and all these things that are considered the basic vices. But what are they in a deeper sense? A negative emotion is really that which, even more than positive emotions, obscures what you really are. A positive emotion reminds you, in a sense, of what you are. I'll describe this anatomically so that it becomes a little bit more clear. When we really rise in bliss, we become centered in what is known as the Sushumna, the central channel in the spine. And this power of Kundalini rises up through the spine to the brain, and that union of these two negative and positive poles in the positive pole in the brain is also what constitutes yoga. When you've got this state of union in yourself, you've reached that level of consciousness that makes you aware of everything as your ultimate reality. Now, as regards your own body, there is an actual physical thing that happens. The energy goes into the deep spine. The energy rises up that deep spine from the base of the spine to the top with the awakening of Kundalini power. Now, outside this deep spine, on either side of it, are what are known as the Ira and the Pingala, or the sympathetic nervous system in our physical bodies, or in our astral bodies, our reactive process. When we feel good, always it's because energy is rising. When we feel bad, always it's because energy is sinking. That's why heaven is described as being above and hell as described as being below. That when the energy in the spine goes into the lower chakras or centers in the spine, we feel unhappy automatically. When that energy rises automatically, we feel more happy, more loving, more kind, more joyful. Now, in this reactive process, the energy that moves in the Ira and the Pingala goes up through the Ira and down in the Pingala. And the reactive process is in fact even tied to the breath. The movement of energy in the Ira and the Pingala is the astral breath. When that energy comes up in the spine, we inhale. When the energy goes down in the spine, we exhale. The movement in the spine relates to the inhalation in an emotional way too. When you feel good, there is always sort of a rising of energy. But because it's in your reactive process, an outward movement, and when you feel good, you inhale. You're joyfully surprised, like this. When you feel bad about something, badly about something, you exhale, you sigh. Because the movement going down in the spine associated with that negative response is a movement that also is associated with the exhalation of the breath. Now then, in this constant movement, this constant fluctuation up and down, we have, in a sense, something that needs to be neutralized. If we look at it only as a cycle, we see that there isn't anything better about an upward movement than a downward movement, because each ends up becoming the opposite. And this, in fact, is the nature of the universe, that in the last analysis, nothing is positive or negative. Nothing is good or bad. Everything is neuter. Everything is neutral. There is only this single point in the middle. This is abstractly. This is objectively, when we look at the world outside us, that we must learn to become impartial to everything and to say, well, it's neither good nor bad, it simply is. But in our own inner selves, there is another aspect to it that contradicts that thought, in a sense. Because every time you've got that upward moving energy in the spine, it's also, in a sense, trying to... The magnetic flow of that energy moving up in the ira nudges the energy upward in the spine, too. So that when you feel basically cheerful, as Arjuna was told in the Bhagavad Gita, O Arjuna, be thou even-minded and cheerful. What you have with this upward movement is two things. First of all, it in itself has a tendency to nudge that energy upward, if you will accept it. But mostly of all, you'll accept it. And so this is the more important point. If you take it into yourself, then to see things in basically a positive way is to, every time that energy moves up in the ira, you are taking it and referring it back to the sushumna. Every time you have a positive reaction to something, take it into your deeper self. That's what Kriya Yoga does. Kriya Yoga works, first of all, in the ira and pingala. But its real purpose is to work upon the sushumna, to bring your energy into the sushumna. And that's why, instead of thinking of the currents as being on the outside of the spine, we think of them as taking place in the center of the spine. So that every time we feel this movement upward in the reactive process, we take it into the deep spine. And with that thing, with that process, every time you find something that reminds you of this inner joy, you see beauty in nature, you see kindness, you see harmony, you hear harmony, you hear lovely melodies. Everything that is God reminding, in the sense of reminding you of a little touch of that bliss within, if you take it inside, if instead of you're saying, oh, look at that sunset like that, and looking always outward, and all your energy is going out to that sunset, if instead you take it into yourself and say, isn't that lovely, God, aren't you beautiful? And God is in your own heart, and it reminds you of that beauty that you have with you everywhere. So that when the sun finally goes down and it's nothing but gray clouds, you still can feel that same joy going on. So in that way, it's sort of like priming a pump. You get the energy flowing and you take it within, and then that positive reaction helps to generate that movement upward within the spine. Well, is it possible then to use negative movement also to draw within the spine? It's interesting. You read, for example, in Autobiography of a Yogi, how when Master was given the experience of cosmic consciousness, he said his breath was sucked out of his lungs as if by a mystic syringe, doesn't he? Going into ecstasy, the breath is drawn out of the body, going into superconsciousness. So here we find a downward exhalation, which is normally related to this downward movement, and yet it's not negative. What happens again is, but this is a more difficult thing, you can use positive emotions to help generate this. Generally speaking, negative emotions take you just downward in the spine. They strengthen that lower center, the polarity of that lower center, they strengthen its pull downward, so that if you incline to be pessimistic or moody or angry or all these things, always the mood and the movement of your energy will be into the lower three chakras. But Once you have gotten yourself into a basically upward move, then you bring that energy downward. That's why the completion of Kriya Yoga is not the inhalation, but the exhalation. When you then bring that energy downward and sink into your deep self, instead of a sigh, it becomes a renunciation. You're leaving the world out. You're saying, oh, this world reminds me of God. And so the energy rises up at the sight of beauty. But then you say, yes, but this God is inside. So I don't need that outward beauty to remind me of what I have with me all the time. Goodbye. And you go within yourself. Do you see what I'm saying? These are subtle moves that take place every time you inhale and exhale. Very subtle. But they are epitomized in this process of inhalation and exhalation, epitomized in this upward and downward movement in the Irda and the Pingala. If you're going to have emotions, have positive emotions, because they will at least start pulling that energy upward. When you've gotten to the point where you've taken it within, then that up and downward move, it's really the same thing, because each one reminds you of the inner self. The one reminds you of the joy within. The other reminds you that that joy isn't anywhere else, that that joy is only within. And with that recognition is when we renounce the world completely in superconsciousness. The breath is drawn out of our lungs, not with a sigh of rejection or disappointment, but with a simple affirmation and realization that, no, I don't need this anymore. I am complete within myself. Now, a negative emotion, then, essentially is negative only because it takes us in the wrong direction. A negative emotion is negative only because it takes us out of harmony with our true self. We get out of harmony with joy and experience suffering, and it isn't what we want. What makes possessiveness, selfishness, what makes these things wrong? If you were to think about yoga only from the standpoint of affirming your own self, then selfishness would be right. Nothing wrong with it. But you realize from your own experience that if you are selfish, you never can experience happiness. Selfish people accept... selfish people, at least to the extent that, or in those departments of their lives in which they are selfish, selfish people can never be happy in those departments. I think it's conceivable that a selfish person could be happy in some ways, but that happiness will always be because he's doing the right thing in some other avenue of his life. In that avenue of his life where he's being selfish, he cannot find happiness. Why not? Because this affirmation of the self, of the ego, goes directly counter to the impulse of the soul. The ego wants to bring everything to a focus here. The soul wants to expand. The soul came from God, and the soul wants to recognize all things as a part of itself. So that anything that expands our consciousness, expands our sympathies, expands our wisdom, expands our sense of identity. That's why Jesus said it's more blessed to give than to receive. Blessed meaning blissful. You feel more bliss when you share with others than when you keep a thing for yourself. When you share, your consciousness and your sympathies expand. I know a story I've told, which I think is worth touching on again here, even for those who have heard it before, just as a reminder of this truth. Years ago, in 1955, I went on a tour as the leader of the Center Department in Self-Realization Fellowship. I went to Europe. And when I was in Switzerland, I saw a carving that was really beautiful. And I thought I'd love to have it. It was the nicest carving I had seen in my travels. And it was fairly expensive. I wasn't sure I could afford it. And I was worried also about the thought, well, but I don't want to own things personally, because then that's a certain kind of bondage. But then I thought, well, I have the desire to buy it, so let me instead buy it for Dayamata. And so I bought it and gave it to her when I came back. I had the pleasure of buying it and acquiring it. I had the pleasure of giving it. And I had all the pleasure that I'd ever have had if I'd owned it, because every time I would visit her, there it would be, and I'd be able to see it and enjoy it. You see, in giving, we don't deprive ourselves. In sharing with others, we actually increase our own happiness. But as soon as there is that thought of I and mine, there is a limitation, there is a feeling of bondage. Every time you have a thought of I and mine, you're putting up another bar in your prison of ego. We've got to get away from this prison of I and mine. Breaking down those bars is the whole, what it's all about. So, to break down those bars, get rid of the thought of I and mine, get rid of the thought of negative expectations, which is really what negative emotions are all about. I get angry with you if you disappoint my desires. I get hateful again because you're doing things that I feel are not what I want. It's always in some way or another disappointing an expectation that we create for ourselves in the first place, some kind of frustrated desire. A negative emotion ultimately simply takes us out of an awareness of this reality of who and what we are, that we are one with all these other people. We don't need to take from them. Affirm it by giving to them, by sharing with them. Okay, to get rid of negative emotions then, what are the principles we've talked about so that we can bring this down onto a practical level? The first thing is what I was saying inwardly. It's a very helpful thing. Inwardly try to get into this upward trend. Recognize that outward things don't really matter. They aren't a part of what you are. Accept whatever is as it is. When things go contrary to your desires or expectations, tell yourself, well, but this is what's happening. So let me learn to adjust myself to it. As Sri Yukteswar said, do you expect to change the world? Change yourself. You can't change the way other people will treat you. Then learn how to treat yourself differently. Learn how to respond differently to the way they treat you. You will find that as you develop that kind of attitude, the worse they treat you, the more fun it becomes for you. Because you don't care. You find yourself thinking, well, I wonder how rude he can be. And it just doesn't bug you anymore. The complete freedom within the self is what we need to achieve. Now then, that means inwardly get into this reactive process and realize that the real movement is within yourself. And when you find that somebody's doing something you don't like, you'll feel this energy going down in your spine and nudging that energy of Kundalini downward. In fact, every time you have a good thought, a kind thought, an uplifting thought, a joyful thought, that loosens Kundalini, Master said, and helps to raise the Kundalini upwardly. He said it's not just a matter of meditation and techniques. Every time you have a negative thought, every time you have an angry thought, a hateful thought, whatever it might be, you're sending that energy downward and locking the Kundalini more at the base of the spine, reaffirming this polar opposition within yourself. So every time you feel a negative emotion toward anybody, tell yourself, I just have to accept this is what is. I must learn to change myself. I can't change what's going on outside. Let me take it into my deeper self and realize that nothing can touch that deeper self. How do you get rid of fear? By realizing nothing can touch you. Bring that energy into yourself and bring that energy up. One thing that can help you to bring that energy up is by deep breathing, creating a magnet that draws the energy up the spine. Another way is, or maybe we could put it this way, first do some deep breathing, then put your mind deeply at the point between the eyebrows and let that be a magnet that draws all your energy up here. And when you have that upward flow of energy inside, you won't even see negativity as such. It won't bother you at all as it would have bothered you when your mind was downward and moving downward. So, get within yourself. Get centered within yourself. Try to raise that energy within yourself. Do various things that will help to raise that energy. And then one thing that can help you is to try to have positive thoughts, to feed your mind with those things that will make you feel good. For example, if you find something, I remember there was one of the monks at Mount Washington was sort of a bitter pill for us to swallow. And I said something to St. Lin, Rajarshi Janakananda, about him one time. And he said, yes, but he has great love for Master. And that was true, he did. That was his saving grace. But St. Lin always looked at the positive side. Well, if you will always try, even in an emotional way, to look at the positive side, when you see something negative about something, try to think about all the good points that he has. When you have negative thoughts, try to feed your mind on cheerful thoughts. That's a positive emotion, really. But positive emotion is easier to get into yourself from than negative emotion. So try to create ideas in your mind that give you cause for being grateful, cause for saying yes to life. It's very important that we learn to say yes to life. When we are, when we speak of being impartial in ourselves, we should at the same time always look for cause to remind us of this inner joy. And not to draw a fine point on it, that means simply to say to yourself how wonderful this world is. It'll help you. To respond joyfully to the world outside will help you to affirm and attain this joy inside. So then, to overcome negative emotions, if you think of overcoming hatred, if you think of overcoming sorrow, if you think of overcoming jealousy in specific ways, then you've got something that's more peripheral to the subject than what I'm talking about here. We could perhaps, in any case, touch briefly on these other things more in their peripheral aspect. For example, hatred. I would bring these things back always away from any idea of the scriptures say you've got to behave in such and such a way, and therefore, without knowing why, you jolly well will have to. Rather, bring them back to the level of why you should live in such and such ways. God doesn't care how you behave. He's complete in himself. It's for our own sake that we should behave properly, because we feel joy when we act in tune with him, and we feel miserable when we act out of tune with that higher self. So here's one good reason for not hating. When you hate people, you draw them to you. If you don't like people, why draw them to you? Master said that sometimes you will find families where they're always at each other's throats, always fighting. He says they were enemies in past lives, and they were attracted by that power of hatred, and were born into a situation where they had to fight it out at close quarters. Well, if you don't want that, that's a very good reason not to hate, isn't it? Something that a friend of ours, John Ball, said was, I thought, delightful. He said, love your enemies. It'll bug the hell out of them. It'll drive them crazy. Well, that may be not the best reason for loving your enemies, but if you can't come up with a better one, start there. I gave you the central reality that if you express this divine consciousness, you'll automatically get into a more positive trend. But there are also very good, sound, practical reasons for loving and not hating. When you hate people, nothing seems to go right. They're always out to hurt you. When you love them, they are out to help you. And I was talking about this recently, that in any situation, if you will think of it not as a rivalry, but as a partnership, you'll be amazed at how much you can accomplish. I've been having that thought lately because I've been buying things for a tape recording department so I could make recordings and make radio programs and so on, and I've needed a new car. And so I've had some pretty big expenses. And I always like to try to hold back on especially these expenses being church expenses. But bargaining isn't something that's done in this country, is it? But I feel, how do people usually bargain? This is an example of what I'm talking about. How do they bargain? The usual technique is to say, that crummy thing is not worth that and you know it. Well, that only makes the man uptight. I found that a much, much better technique is to say to people, is to think of the man selling you something as your partner. not your opponent. True, you're trying to beat him down and he's trying to jack it up. And in this, it looks like an opposition. But if instead you think of yourselves, both of you, as partners in a joint venture, which is somehow transferring this piece of property, then you find a totally different state of mind. You feel a certain concern that he earn his necessary commission for himself, and that makes him feel a concern that naturally you would want to get it as cheaply as you can. And, well, the point being that if you hate people, or if you look upon them as your rivals, then you create that thought in them. Whereas if you look upon them as your friends, if you look upon them with love, there's every reason in the world for your own sake that you should love people. First of all, you're happier when you love people. I got a letter when I was in India a couple of years ago telling me about some friend of mine who had become my enemy in his mind. And I thought within my heart, well, I love him, and I'm happier loving him than not loving him. So I'm not going to become a satellite. I'm not going to accept his reality. I choose to love him. And for no other reason than that it makes me feel happy loving him. How he treats me, how he thinks about me, that's his problem and his business. It doesn't matter to me. If we can love people that way, that's what Master said. That's what he meant when he said to me, I give you my unconditional love. And then he asked me if I would give him my unconditional love. And I said yes, but he was probing deeper into my consciousness. And he said that when he had met his guru had said, will you give me your unconditional love after giving his? And Yogananda said, I said to him, what if ever I find you to be less than a Christ-like master? And Sri Yukteswar said, I don't want your love, it stinks. Like this. He had a very contemptuous and sarcastic way of expressing himself when he chose to. But Master got the point. And of course, Master's love really was unconditional. It was just that Sri Yukteswar was affirming that thought because Master was already a master. But he told me that story in order to help me to realize, because he saw that I would have doubts in future and so on, but to understand that if love is unconditional, it doesn't change for any reason at all. When we have that kind of love, then only can we say we love. Until then, it isn't love. It would have been self-love to say, well, I love this person for what I'm getting out of him. The reason we love people should be just because we feel God's love in our heart, and it's the nature of that love to want to express itself. We feel a greater joy, we feel a greater fulfillment, loving than not loving. In that spirit we should love. In that spirit we can help other people. And a negative emotion takes us away from what we really want, because our nature is love. And when we hate, we get out of tune with what we are. That's why people who hate can never know happiness. Emotions of revenge and so on are negative emotions, because they take us out of attunement with our own selves. Jealousy is the same thing. Jealousy is self-love. You have no control, no right to expect to have any control over the way another person behaves. He has his own freedom before God. And if he chooses to make a mistake, you can grieve for him. You can try to help him. You have no right to demand anything of him. No one has a right to demand anything of another human being, even in the closest of human associations. Master, although he expected obedience from us, he never forced his will on us. It always was left up to our free will whether we would respond properly. And the only reason he spoke of obedience was for our sake, was that then there would be this open channel between us and him. So to have a right attitude in all times is meaningful because it's fulfilling to you. And to have a negative attitude is harmful because it's harmful to you. It doesn't matter what it does to society. As far as you are concerned, you are the center of the universe. And that's where you've got to bring harmony first. Then perhaps you can help to bring harmony to others. But unless you've got harmony within yourself, you won't bring harmony to others, no matter how many good works you try to accomplish. So, with jealousy, with hatred, with moods, with all these emotions, we find that it's always coming back to these same basic principles. And because it's so simple in the last analysis, I doubted whether I could speak for an hour and a half, and in fact, I have not spoken for an hour and a half. And so what we could do is give you a chance to ask questions if you have any. Yes?
Yes, well, I would like to know, how do we know when we're, instead of getting rid of a negative emotion, when we're suppressing it or burying it?
I think we've got to be perfectly honest with ourselves. That means being so impartial as to be willing to see ourselves as we are. To be willing to be wrong is an example. Just to say it, whatever is, is. It doesn't matter. We usually think that, well, I've committed myself to a particular point of view and therefore I've just got to stand by it with all weapons possible. But whatever is remains what it is forever. So if you've got a fault, the tendency of the mind is, and I've seen this many times with people, they themselves will say, oh, well, I know I've got faults. I have always laughed at Jimmy Hoffa's statement, well, I know I got faults, but being wrong ain't one of them. And so they'll say, yes, I know I have faults, but then you point out one fault of theirs. Oh, no, not that one. Instead of that kind of emotional cry of, no, it can't be that, say, well, is it? Why shouldn't it be? I'm here for some reason. I mean, obviously I've got something wrong or I wouldn't be in this planet. There are much better ones to be on. So rather than say, oh, no, I don't have that fault, say, well, maybe here's an opportunity to maybe find something that is standing between me and my God. So that when you have the possibility of a fault, look on it gratefully rather than defensively. Look on it thinking, oh boy, maybe here's an opportunity to understand myself more deeply. And it may not be so. Many times people will tell you you've got something wrong with you that's their problem, not your problem. That's what I have against these encounter groups and so on, where people tell you what they think of you. It's a waste of your energy. Half the time they're just projecting their own poison. And I just don't think most people's opinions matter very much, on many issues at least. They've all got something. But for them to be right about you when you've had to live with yourself for many years and they've just met you yesterday, I don't know. They might help you. I would always listen. But I'm afraid that many people get tied up into too many emotional knots listening to these things. I'd say rather, listen to wise people. Listen to people who really are wanting to help you, not the kind of friend who wants to flatter you, but the friend who wants your own happiness and your own growth. And more than that, listen to your own inner voice. So when people say anything, or when it seems as if you may have a fault, instead of saying, no, I don't, say, well, do I? Maybe. If I do, wonderful, I've got something to work on, and I've at last discovered one more thing that's standing between me and growth. But, in other words, don't suppress it. Then, the next thing is, suppressing it means not facing it. That's all it's really about. It's trying to tell yourself it isn't so. You don't have to work on every fault. I know Henry David Thoreau said that if you see a fault in society or in the human condition around you, you must fight it. He was talking specifically of slavery. But the truth is that if you see millions of faults, how are you going to fight all those millions of problems? You have to choose your battles. A general can't be fighting the whole, can't be spreading his army over a whole border. He has to invade at one point with a concentrated force. And so it is also with us that when we face a particular problem in ourselves, we have to ask ourselves next the question, am I ready to handle this problem? If not, I'll put it up there on a shelf labeled jealousy under J, and when I'm ready for it, I'll face it. So I haven't suppressed it. I've merely put it there for future attention while I'm busy fighting another battle. Or it may be that the fault is so great that you don't have the energy yet to win. And I'd say that a very important key would be to take up those battles that you think you can win, because there's a great setback when you lose. So even if you do lose, say, I haven't yet succeeded. Don't say I've lost. And that saying, I haven't yet succeeded, will be an affirmation of potential success that will gradually take you to ultimate victory. But better still would it be to take on those things that you have a fair chance of winning. Because then, in the process of victory, you will gain two things, self-confidence and strength. And the stronger you become, a boxer doesn't box the champion. He boxes lesser boxers, and gradually he develops his skills until finally he thinks he can take on the champ. And so with our struggles with these negative qualities, take on those things that you think you can handle. Gradually, as you become stronger, you'll be able to pull that off the shelf and say, okay, now I'm ready for you. Take on, I'd say, one struggle at a time and win it before you go on to the next one. Sometimes life won't let you do that. At least if it doesn't, always be sure to be centered in yourself so you don't get thrown off balance. Even if you blow it, say, my inner self isn't touched. Even if you fail 1,000 times, say, well, here I'm strong. Here I am myself. Nothing can touch what I really am in my deeper self. We have to have faith in that God within us, or we'll never grow. Okay? Yes, Haridas.
Swamiji, could you share a little bit about the quality of frankness?
Frankness. Well, I think it's important for us to realize several aspects of that, really. The first being that, yes, we should be open and honest, but ultimately what we should say is we should be truthful. Master defined truthfulness as beneficial. He said the truth is always beneficial. Facts may not be beneficial. You see a sick man and you say, gosh, you look absolutely rotten. It'll make him more sick. If you say, you look fine, you're well, it may not be a fact, but it's a truth in as much as his soul can never be sick. And you're affirming a reality that can give him that energy to make him better. So truthfulness, in this sense, means to help bring out an attunement with that truth that we're talking about, doesn't it? Well, that's what we mean partly then by frankness, that we should say those things that will be helpful to other people. But that word, frank, has a lot of connotations besides just that. There's a lot of ego in many people's supposedly frank and open remarks. They have no right to think that they're that right that they have to just come out and blurt anything that happens to be in their minds. There should be this kind of respect for where another person is. This is something I used to have with Master very often. He would very often scold me because I was too frank. And he would tell me that you should think about what effect your words are going to have. Think about whether it's necessary to say that. And I realized over a period of time how very right he was, that think of whether, have the humility to admit to yourself that you may not be right. I've met a lot of people who pride themselves on their frankness, who waste their energy spouting stupidities. Don't be so sure that your opinions are right. Frankness very often means being too wedded to our own opinions. But more important than that, whatever your opinion may be, have respect for where another person is too. Have respect for what his, not only for what you need to say, but for what he needs to hear. I found in counseling people that that's very, very important. To, in a sense, listen to what other people are saying, not with their mouths, but with their consciousness. Listen to what their own higher self is trying to say to them. And then talk from that higher self rather than from what my opinion of the situation or what my experience in similar situations would be. Try to talk from the standpoint of what he needs to hear. Frankness has that connotation of putting out, not listening. And that's the negative side of it. To be ingenuous to be open and frank is a very positive and beautiful quality, as long as we keep these qualifications in mind also. We don't want to be diplomats in the insincere sense, but we want to be diplomats in the sense of having respect for another person's realities and not trying to impose our realities on him. Yes?
Does food affect the emotions one way or the other?
It does, in fact. The meat is, especially beef and pork, the violent emotions that the animals feel when they're being killed affects your own consciousness, your own emotions. People who eat a lot of meat, especially the higher advanced animals, are subject to much more emotions. They're much more emotional peoples. Another thing is the consciousness of the person preparing the food. That too is a vibration that gets into the food. Certain foods are calm. I've often laughed at this example. Master said that certain foods like cherries make you cheerful, and bananas make you humble, and so on. And so they've played music to plants, and they've discovered that plants respond in a particular way. Well, certain plants are rajasic. They are more active in their vibration, according to yogis. Others are more peaceful. Radishes, for example, onions, garlic, they would be rajasic foods. They would activate your system. And what amused me was that when they played music to these different vegetables and plants, they found that most of them seemed to like classical music or waltz music, but radishes love jazz. Okay, let's have a few moments of silence.